This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bean Cooley, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. It's been a good year for Benedict Cumberbatch. He's earned an Oscar nomination for his starring role in the film The Imitation Game, and won critical acclaim and a big American following for his performance on the masterpiece TV series Sherlock. Its third season aired in 2014 on PBS. Cumberbatch played Julian Assange in the film The Fifth Estate, and has appeared in the films War Horse, 12 Years a Slave, August Osage County, and in the Hobbit series, where he provided the voice of Smaug the Dragon. In The Imitation Game, Cumberbatch plays Alan Turing, the brilliant, eccentric mathematician who led the team charged with breaking the sophisticated Enigma code used by Nazi forces in World War II to encrypt their radio transmissions. Cumberbatch spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies earlier this month, and they began with a clip from the film. It's 1939, and Cumberbatch, as Turing, is being interviewed by a naval commander, played by Charles Dance, about participating in a top-secret project. Turing, who's figured out that it must be an effort to break the Enigma code, speaks first.
Of course that's what you're working on. But you also haven't got anywhere with it. If you had, you wouldn't be hiring cryptographers out of university. You need me a lot more than I need you. I like solving problems, Commander. And Enigma is the most difficult problem in the world.
No, Enigma isn't difficult, it's impossible. The Americans, the Russians, the French, the Germans, everyone thinks Enigma is unbreakable.
Good. Let me try, and we'll know for sure, won't we?
Benedict Cumberbatch, welcome to Fresh Air. Alan Turing is an amazing man. It's an amazing story. I mean, he was really a very historically significant scientist. I mean, he made advances in the digital revolution and, of course, breaking the Enigma code. And
he's the father of modern computer science, which means, you know, he took what Ada Lovelace and Babbage did hundreds of years before into a reality, a physical reality, away from loom machines and other kind of, you know, early machinated calculating machines. He created the idea that we now hold of as the universal machine as well, the singular language that programs all computers. Any algorithm you use for a search engine to say, to put Alan Turing's name in, which embarrassingly now links up with mine, that search engine, that's the same algorithm that was used to crack the code in the Second World War. I mean, it's extraordinary how important he is.
It's clear you have a real attachment to this character. Was it hard to let him go?
Sorry, I keep on interrupting your questions to talk about him. Sorry, I can't help it.
Right, let me...
It wasn't hard to let him go, but I do still feel incredibly loyal to him, but I felt very close to him, yeah. I suppose in that way it was difficult. We filmed the last scenes very near the end of my filming schedule, and for the first couple of takes, those scenes with Kira, when she visits him in the 50s in Manchester after the treatments well and truly underway.
And let's just explain for the audience. We're talking about treatments. He was arrested for, indecency because he was homosexual, and there were these... He agreed to take hormone treatments to, quote, cure him instead of going to jail, and that was, you know, the beginning of a very awful end for him.
That's exactly right. The choice then for men who were arrested and prosecuted for being gay was the choice between 2 years imprisonment or 2 years chemical castration through weekly estrogen injections. This is less than 100 years ago in a country that had just been liberated from the threat of fascism by one of the very men that they then punished for his sexuality. I mean, it's barbaric, it's frightening, and sadly it's not a history lesson. It's something that we need to be equally wary of in our current climate of intolerance, whether it's with fundamentalism, whether it's nationalism, but we see the same people, men and women, being scapegoated. The ridiculousness of transsexuals not being allowed to have a driver's license in Russia. I mean, that's just, it's comic, but actually it's not for people in Russia. It seems unfathomable to us, but that's a reality. And to think that's the tip of the iceberg of what's going on still. Very, very important part of his story. But what I was going to say was he, in that period, chose the estrogen injections rather than the imprisonment in order to be able to continue his work. And the estrogen injections not only corrupted his mind, but started to eat away at his body, but it also ate away at his faculty, at his mind. And he lost this athletic body. He also lost a mind that was attuned to the one thing he was left to love and focus on, which was his work. And I think ultimately that was the undoing of his strength and power to live.
Let's hear another scene from The Imitation Game. This is a moment where you are working with a part of the team that's working to break the Enigma code. And some of your mates come and try and invite you to lunch. We're going to hear from the head of the team, who's played by Matthew Good. Another intelligence officer played by Alan Leach speaks first.
The boys, we're going to get some lunch. Alan?
Yes?
I said we're going to get some lunch. Alan?
Yes?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
I said we're off to get some lunch. This is starting to get a little bit repetitive.
What is?
I had asked if you wanted to come to lunch with us.
No, you didn't. You said you were going to get some lunch.
Have I offended you in some way?
Why would you think that?
Would you like to come to lunch with us?
What time's lunchtime?
Christ, Alan, it's a bleeding sandwich.
What is?
Lunch.
Oh, I don't like sandwiches.
Never mind.
And that's our guest, Benedict Cumberbatch, playing Alan Turing in the new film, The Imitation Game. You don't strike me as somebody who's particularly socially awkward. I mean, was it difficult to you to get into the mentality of this guy and come out of it?
No. You know, I've turned up to costume parties in the wrong costume. I've made social faux pas aplenty. I've put one foot in front of the other and fallen over. I mean, you know, if you've ever experienced the idea of feeling slightly outside, or that kind of, you know, the creeping paranoia of a teenager where you just feel that you don't quite fit into anything, where you're just finding out who you are and everyone else seems to have got it sorted, and only in your late 20s do you turn around and go, did you have weird thoughts about not right. quite knowing where you were, who you were, what you were when you were growing up? And you realize it's a universal human trait. But, you know, I think what formulated very early in his life was this incredible sensitiveness to the world and his environment and the way people treated him in it. And that was born out of having a stammer. For me, that was the key to understanding him as a child who didn't have the parental nourishment he needed. It was very normal in those days for parents to be absent, but his parents were absent for long stretches of time. They worked in the diplomatic in India, and one year they came back, probably after a whole year, to discover their, I think it was about 3 or 4 by then, old child had a stammer, and his mother was shocked. And I think what he's become as a younger man is very closed off, very single-minded, very purposeful, acutely pedantic and accurate with language to a near autistic level, but I think that word is banded around too much, both for this character and for people who do have autism. And I think, you know, you see what has happened to him thaw when he meets and trusts someone else who he loves in the shape of Kira's character, Joan Clark.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with actor Benedict Cumberbatch. He stars in the new film, The Imitation Game. You grew up the child of two actors. Did they expose you to the business, and did it have appeal?
You can't not be exposed to the business if you grow up a child of two actors. It's everywhere, from, you know, their social life to the peripatetic and ever sort of chaotic kind of calendar of their work life. So, yeah, I was fully aware of the ups and downs of a very unstable living.
How did they feel about you getting into it?
Awful. They worked incredibly hard to afford me an education where I would be privileged enough to have the choice of pursuing anything but being an actor. So going into the law or medicine or teaching or anything other than, you know, doing what they did. But I just kept kicking it back. I kept on doing plays at school. I really enjoyed it. I pursued the idea of being a barrister for a while, but I met too many people along the road saying, turn back now, and giving me the same reasons as I'd heard for not being an actor. So I thought, well, why am I giving up on my primary dream for a backup that's equally risky?
You wouldn't have been at the Golden Globes that way. I think that's fair to say.
Who knows? Well, no, there were lawyers there. You know, okay. I'm sure some of them are frustrated actors.
There are lawyers everywhere.
Damn right, yeah.
The lore is that your acting debut at age 12 was as Titania, the Queen of Fairies, in A Midsummer Night's Dream?
No, way before that. Sadly, it was at primary school, age dot, question mark, can't remember. I mean, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5. There's a rather impatient Joseph who thought Mary was taking too long and apparently pushed her off the stage, much to the delight of the parents. But probably not Mary, but that was a very sort of ungenerous and embarrassing beginning, and especially for my poor parents. Obviously, you know, people recognise from the television and theatre that they'd done, and to have their son, their only son, pushing another child off stage must have been sort of funny but mortifying at the same time. No, Titania was the first play I did at my second boarding school at Harrow, which is an all-male boarding school, quite sort of a machismo, army and sports deaning kind of environment, very jockey rather than academic, but it was an odd thing for somebody who played flanker in the rugby team to do by night, to get dressed up in a wig and a sort of pineapple type paper crown that made me look like, you know, Cleo Lane on a bad day, swanning on being the queen of the fairies.
You studied drama in Manchester and did a lot of work in on theater and film and television, and best known to American audiences, I suppose, for Sherlock, which we got to talk about. And I thought we would play a clip. This is from, I think this might even be the first episode where you're examining the body of a woman on the floor, and with you are a detective inspector played by Rupert Graves, and of course, Dr. Watson, who is played by Martin Freeman. You've just briefly, as Sherlock, looked at the woman's body, but you have some observations. Let's listen.
Victim is in her late 30s, professional person going by her clothes and guessing something in the media, going by the frankly alarming shade of pink. Traveled from Cardiff today, intending to stay in London for one night. It's obvious from the size of her suitcase.
Suitcase?
Suitcase, yes. She's been married for at least 10 years. But not happily. She's had a string of lovers, but none of them knew she was married.
Oh, for God's sake, if you're just making this up...
Her wedding ring, 10 years old at least. The rest of her jewellery has been regularly cleaned, but not her wedding ring. State of her marriage, right there. The inside of the ring is shinier than the outside. That means it's regularly removed. The only polishing it gets is when she works it off her finger. It's not for work. Look at her nails. She doesn't work with her hands. So what, or rather, who does she remove her rings for? Clearly not one lover. She'd never sustain the fiction of being single over that amount of time, so more likely a string of them. Simple.
It's brilliant. Sorry, Cardiff?
It's obvious, isn't it?
It's not obvious to me.
Dear God, what is it like in your funny little brains? It must be so boring.
And the one and only Sherlock. That's our guest, Benedict Cumberbatch, as Sherlock. Okay, tell us about this Sherlock. What's your kind of psychological profile of this guy?
Well, the same as the books. You know, a very flamboyant, flawed, brilliant human being, somebody who sacrificed a lot in order to gain an exceptional ability to interpret the world around him, someone who can look at the mundane and create a pop-up adventure of potential outcomes and adventures, somebody who is irascible, flamboyant, arrogant, vicariously, pleasurably intolerant of mediocrity and the mundanity of bureaucracy, somebody who is who underestimates the true value of kinship and friendship and being part of a world rather than just being the best in a field in the world, and gets his comeuppance and slowly matures into somebody with, you know, a humanized edge to his otherworldly brilliance.
Yeah, that's
it. You could put that. Yeah, that's on the box set. That's the flyleaf cover.
As I listen to you as Sherlock, kind of just rippling off these observations about this dead woman's body.
Yeah,
I'm picturing you
And I speak faster than that in some moments. This is the craziness. I was listening back to that now going, it's quite slow, really, by now standards.
That was slow?
We do it a lot faster.
Wow.
Well, because I was moving around, probably, so I could only fit certain paragraphs in with just bending over the body, getting up, looking under the collar. You know, there was all that stuff about Cardiff, the weather, the collar turned up against the... and that was to come after, dear God, what is it like inside your tiny little brains? It must be so boring. And It takes hours to learn. It takes one mistake for the whole house of cards to tumble, and many sweaty takes, especially when it's, you know, a one-off shot or a single shot that Paul McGuigan in that episode, for example, wanted me to get it in. And a lot of very patient actors around me just waiting for me to get it right, I guess.
It sounded to me like you were just doing it just now. I mean, you were just like speeding your voice up another two takes, no?
What, just by talking? Well, yeah.
Yeah, just talking about it.
That happens.
Yeah.
That does. It happens. It reminds me I can actually talk faster. And I start talking faster. I also get told that I can be impatient and a little bit dismissive when I'm playing him. I think, you know, you risk taking a certain amount of your work home as an actor. And you play strong characters like that, some of it rubs off on you.
His companion, of course, Dr. Watson, is played by Martin Freeman, who is a terrific actor. We're just seeing more and more of him as time goes on. And I read that you described him as one of the few actors who actually raised your game. Is that true?
In the audition, yeah. No, the minute he came in to read, and we had some fantastic reads, brilliant actors, some who were a little bit too much in the vein of where I was going with Sherlock, either because they were picking up on my energy or because that's what they could have contributed, which made me a bit nervous. I thought, Christ, they'll get my job. But Martin stepped in, and I felt myself complimented in a really good sort of chalk and cheese mismatch kind of a way, which is our dynamic. And, you know, he's such a fine craftsman. He's so specific. It's he works incredibly hard, but makes it look effortless. It's breathing to watch. It's just, you know, there's nothing of hard work that he shows off with, unlike me, unlike, you know, the kind of flamboyance of that character, who is very showy. There's this quiet kernel of truth in everything that Martin does, and he's painfully funny, very wise man to be around. So yeah, he's a game raiser for whoever is lucky enough to work with him. But the minute we met in the audition, I thought, well, this would be wonderful. And the door closed and I went, please, it's got to be him. And Stephen Moffat, I think, in the same breath was saying, well, I think we just found our Watson. Oh, great.
Stephen Moffat and Mark Gatiss are the creators, right? And now, I have to ask you, do you think this character, Sherlock, do you think of him as having sex appeal?
You're asking the wrong target audience, really. So no, I don't.
Well, I mean, you.
But if I was,
you're pretty insightful about characters.
Well, okay, all right. Being really sort of hyper objective about it, yeah. I kind of do. I do understand it because he's aloof. He's pretty cold and mean, but he's utterly brilliant. Can be incredibly charming, incredibly capable, and smart and funny, but also flawed. And I think. I think he's rather a thrilling person to spend time with.
Well, of course, I ask because, you know, with this role, I mean, you became really popular in the United States and on all of these sexiest man alive lists. And I'm just, you know, this was, you know, many years into your career.
I'm just, well, you've got it. I mean, that's the formula. It's a projection of work. And that's where you're right to ask that question about whether Sherlock's sexy, because I sure as hell ain't. And, you know, I've been around for 10 or 15 years before this happened, and I wasn't on any lists of the millionth most attractive.
Well, I can tell you planet, two, you know, people so. Ranging in ages 10 to 60 were just so excited and are totally in love with you. What does it do to your head to have these millions of women thinking of you that way?
It's just very flattering, and I kind of it makes me giggle, as they know, because it's sort of silly. And where it is serious and where it is a compliment is, I do, because of what we just discussed, I think it is a reflection of the work and hopefully how I come across when I'm talking about the work, rather than what I actually have got as a physical object of itself every morning in a mirror. You know, I take it as a sort of skewed compliment. You know, it ain't what you got, it's the way that you do what you've got with, sort of thing. Do you know what I mean? It's like,
it's Sherlock they love, huh? Not Benedict.
Well, yeah. I don't know. You ask them. It might be a mixture of both. And, you mm-hmm. know, I do other roles that they seem to watch me in as well. So while that may have been the first kind of platform for that attraction, I think it's about the work in general.
This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, we're speaking with actor Benedict Cumberbatch. He stars in the film The Imitation Game. You play the voice of Smaug the Dragon for the Hobbit films. And, you know, when I heard the film and I heard your voice, I mean, it's obviously not your speaking voice. And I thought, well, this is highly processed. But then I heard you on a talk show and you did the voice, and it was amazingly like that voice, just plain. And I don't want to turn you into a parlor trick here, but could you give us a little of Smaug, I don't know, ordering lunch or a cocktail?
You're listening to NPR. I'm Smaug. And I just burnt the microphone.
That's a little bit of him.
You can hear me, but you can't smell me or see me.
I mean, that's sort of what I originally did, and I did it for a while, and my voice was going, and Peter said, look, we've got this great thing that Andy used for King Kong. We call it the Congolizer, and it'll just mean you'll be able to get more variation and pitch into your performance, but you will be able to get that effect.
Is it painful to
trash your voice to do it? Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, listen to the normal pitch of my voice. It's not it's not a natural thing to sort of switch to. It always leaves its sort of scars. But, you know, how often do you get to play the dragon of all dragons? So it's something you commit to. It's just, it's endlessly dynamic and challenging, both to how you produce the sound and what the sound is. And the same with being a dragon crawling around on your belly. You know, you're stretching, you're over-articulating your neck. So there were all sorts of sort of journeys of discovery with that, which were, great, you know. I was in a room much like this recording booth I'm in now, with kind of uninspiring grey carpet, grey walls, bit of wooden cladding, and these amazing sensors in the corners of the ceiling.
So you did the motion capture to portray the dragon as well.
Yeah, and that's how the voice evolved, absolutely. And they did a lot of facial recognition motion capture as well as full body. And yeah, there is quite a parity before we used the Congolizer. And you're a child, you're playing again, you're utterly free, there are no restrictions, no hair, makeup, continuity, marks, camera, lens sizes. There aren't even any other actors. I mean, you're free falling. It's great, great, great fun.
You played Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks, in the film The Fifth Estate. Fascinating story and a fascinating guy. And
yeah.
And presents a lot of issues. And I know that when you were preparing for the role, you had some communication with Assange himself. And this has been written about. Do you want to just give us an idea of what that was like?
Yeah, no, Julian wrote me a very thorough, charming, intelligent email pleading with me to walk from the project the day before we started shooting. I tried to contact him to not only reassure him that we weren't out to assassinate his character, that under no circumstances did we want to denigrate the good that WikiLeaks had done, and the fact that as a fan of human rights, of freedom of information, of the right to be able to publish and the right to be able to express an opinion and not fear censorship, that I completely and utterly championed his cause and him, and was under no way a kind of puppet to the forces that he thought were at work to create a sort of anti-WikiLeaks film and an anti-Julian Assange film. That wasn't what I was after at all. However, I did want to point out that, like myself, the frailties of the human ego, of the fact that relationships soured, of things went wrong, of a great ideal also needed to be examined as well as celebrated. So it was a balanced rather than a one-way weighted kind of bit of State Department propaganda, which he feared it would be. And I said as much in a reply to him, and the rest is private between us. But, you know, I'm full of respect for him and what WikiLeaks achieved in that era. It was an extraordinary moment in time.
We're in award season. You and your films are very much in the mix. What's it like?
Great fun. It's just fun, you know. And, we were at the Golden Globes, and George Clooney got the sort of Lifetime Achievement Award or honor. And he got up there and he said, look, 80% of us tonight will lose. I've been in this room a lot of times, and I have too. I've been lucky enough to be a bride a couple of times, but I've been many more times a bridesmaid at these things. And you just look around at your colleagues and you think, my God, I'm being counted amongst the quality of the work of these men and women, and I get to call them my peers rather than heroes, and which is extraordinary. It's an amazing compliment, and then it just should be fun.
Benedict Cumberbatch, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
Benedict Cumberbatch spoke with Dave Davies earlier this month. Cumberbatch is nominated for an Oscar for his starring role in the film The Imitation Game. The new film American Sniper, starring Bradley Cooper, is based on the memoir by Chris Kyle, a Navy SEAL whose service in Iraq won him numerous medals and made him a kind of mythic figure among his fellow soldiers. Just 2 weeks ago, the film was widely viewed as an awards season afterthought. Then, on January 15th, Clint Eastwood's film was nominated for 6 Oscars, including Best Picture and Best Actor. The following weekend, the film opened wide and broke several box office records. In the process, the film has become something of a cultural lightning rod. Our critic at large, John Powers, has been following the controversy and says the film isn't as simple as some people seem to think.
In the years following the invasion of Iraq, it became a truism that Americans simply didn't want to hear about the war, especially at the movies. While there were scads of films about Iraq, including Kathryn Bigelow's Oscar-winning The Hurt Locker, none was able to attract a big audience. Until American Sniper. Based on the best-selling memoir of the same title, Clint Eastwood's film about Navy SEAL Chris Kyle has not only pulverized box office records, but become a cultural phenomenon, especially in places that often get written off as the heartland. Its unexpected success has become the latest reminder that our prevailing image of American culture, the one in which Lena Dunham is an inescapable juggernaut, is largely based on media folks' idea of what's cool, rather than the whole country's taste. Of course, given today's polarized politics, the film has spawned the usual knee-jerk squabbling. Put crudely, its detractors argue that American Sniper is a right-wing movie that ducks essential questions, like whether the Iraq War was a righteous one, and glorifies a remorseless sniper who killed somewhere between 160 and 250 people. Its defenders on the right accuse such critics of hating America and our troops. The left frets that American Sniper is so popular because it lets viewers stay in denial about Iraq. It doesn't say that the invasion was wrong, wrong, wrong. The right thinks it's so popular because it celebrates good old-fashioned patriotism. Both of these explanations are far too simple for a low-key movie that's striking in its lack of stridency. As one who opposed the Iraq War, I think American Sniper is good. Skillfully made, if sometimes a tad generic, it's anchored by a terrific performance from Bradley Cooper, an articulate, thoughtful actor who completely immerses himself in Chris Kyle, a laconic man who doesn't spend much time questioning things. One reason I like the movie is that it takes me inside a vision of life so very different to my own. American Sniper gives us the world as it's lived and understood by Chris Kyle, who's not especially interested in foreign policy or the daily lives of Iraqis. He's a Texan raised to ideals of service and drawn to activities like bronco riding and hunting. For him, the Navy SEALs are a perfect fit, especially after 9/11. And when he reaches Iraq, he finds his true métier. Being a sniper is stressful. You're trying to protect your comrades while not murdering civilians. But Kyle is so good, he becomes a legend. Back home, though, between tours of duty, his wife, played by Sienna Miller, feels her husband slipping away, as she tells him one night in bed.
Do you want to die? Is that what it is?
No.
Then just tell me. Tell me why you do it.
Oh, come on.
I want to understand.
Babe, I do it for you. You know that I do it to protect
you.
No,
you don't.
Yes, I do.
I'm here. Your family is here. Your children have no father.
You have to serve my country.
You don't know when to quit. You did your part. You sacrificed enough. You let somebody else go.
Let somebody else go?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I couldn't live with myself.
Yeah, well, you find a way. You have to. Okay, I need you to be human again.
If American Sniper was merely the story of Kyle killing bad guys, which is basically how he saw his job, it would feel emotionally flat and meaningless. But Eastwood, who spent decades exploring violence in its many permutations, charges things with complexity and ambivalence. Even as he respects Kyle's self-possessed valor, he's not a danger junkie like Jeremy Renner in The Hurt Locker, Eastwood knows that you can't do what Kyle does and get away untouched. We see the cost of service on Kyle's family, and in the very changes in Cooper's body language, the cost on an honorable man's humanity. While Kyle displays no doubts about the Iraqi mission, some of his fellow soldiers do, the war changes and darkens his soul. Far from being a triumphalist war movie, American Sniper comes tinged with a quiet and sad sense of waste. It finds its culmination in Kyle's murder, handled with great tact, at the hands of a disturbed veteran he's trying to help out. This is a far cry from John Wayne's sergeant being heroically shot down by a Japanese sniper in Sands of Iwo Jima, a battle his troops go on to win. Nobody thinks the U.S. won in Iraq the way it won World War II. The world wasn't saved. In recognizing this, without ever explicitly saying it, American Sniper captures the essentially tragic truth of the war for millions of Americans who admire the bravery, sacrifice, and patriotism of our men and women in uniform. It speaks emotionally to audiences who sense that we lost something in Iraq, yet still want to honor the heroism of those who risked their lives for the cause, whether or not it was ultimately a great one.
John Powers is film and TV critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. Coming up, Understanding the Teenage Brain. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. We're going to talk about some neuroscience that will be of particular interest to the parents of teenagers and to anyone who's ever been a teenager. New research into how the human brain develops helps explain some of the reasons teenagers can be especially impulsive, moody, and not very good at responsible decision-making. New research also explains why teenagers can be especially susceptible to addictions, including drugs, alcohol, smoking, and yes, cell phones. Our next guest is neurologist Dr. Frances Jensen, author of the new book, The Teenage Brain. She's a professor and chair of the Department of Neurology at the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine, and was formerly a Harvard professor and director of translational neuroscience at Boston Children's Hospital. She spoke with Terry last Wednesday.
Dr. Jensen, welcome to Fresh Air.
Great to be here.
So you point out we know now that the brain is the last organ to fully develop.
And that
the teenage brain is still developing, and the part of the brain that's responsible for what's called like executive decision-making, judgment, isn't fully developed yet. It's still starting to develop when kids are in their teens. So which part of the brain is that, and how underdeveloped is it?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the prefrontal and frontal cortex, the very front of your brain. And teenagers are gaining increasing access as they go through their teens to that part of the brain. It used to be thought that children turned into almost adults when they passed through puberty. And they kind of looked like adults, and you had the expectation that their brain, because their body looks like an adult, that their brain should also be structurally like an adult. Well, it's far from the truth. The teenage brain is not there all the way. It takes often into your early 20s and possibly late 20s and, you know, maybe even beyond for the brain to fully mature to adult levels. And one of the main drivers of this is the way our brain connects regions to each other inside the brain. These connection tracks have to be insulated for very fast signaling. And we have a natural insulation that's similar to the insulation around an electrical wire, which is, you know, rubber insulation. We have something, a natural insulation called myelin. It's a fat, and it takes time. Cells have to build myelin, and they grow it around the outside of these tracks. And that takes years. It's interesting. It goes from the back of your brain to the front. So the last place to be connected, to be fully myelinated, is the front of your brain. And what's in the front? Your prefrontal cortex and your frontal cortex. These are areas where we have insight, empathy, these executive functions such as impulse control, risk-taking behavior is suppressed by activity in your frontal lobes.
So what does that explain about teenage behavior?
So it does explain, at least in part, why their frontal lobes are there. They're just not accessed in as rapid a manner because the insulation to the wiring to them isn't fully developed. So the signals go more slowly. Hence, teenagers are not as readily able to access their frontal lobe to say, oh, I better not do this. An adult is much more likely to control impulses or weigh out different factors in decisions, where a teenager may not actually have full online in-the-moment capacity. And that's why we see this increase in risk, you know, classic sort of increase in risky behavior. We talk a lot about the downside of the limitations of, oh, the teen brain, you know, no insight, no judgment. Well, of course, there's some. It's a gradual process. It's not never all or none. But there's also wonderful this is a wonderful time in life for teenagers. This is a time where, because of their enhanced synaptic plasticity, they can learn faster, they can absorb more information, they can...
Well, on a related note, you say teenagers can not only learn faster, but the memories last longer, like they're more deeply ingrained. Why is that?
Well, the whole process of learning and memory is thought to be a process of building stronger connections between your brain cells. Your brain cells create new networks when you learn new tasks and new skills and new memories. And where brain cells connect are called synapses. And the synapse actually gets strengthened the more you use it. And especially if you use it in a patterned way, like with practice, it gets even stronger, such that after the practice, you don't need much effort to remember something. This actually has a scientific basis. It's called long-term potentiation. Long-term meaning it's lasting a long time. Potentiation meaning strengthening. Turns out that if you are stimulating one brain cell and recording from a second brain cell. If you do an initial stimulation, you get a small response from the second brain cell. But if you give a pattern stimulation, fast pattern stimulation akin to a practice session, from that point on, even if you go back to the little small stimulus you used originally, you get a much bigger response on that second neuron. It's now remembered this. And it's how is the response bigger? It's actually physically built a bigger synapse on the receiving end of that second cell. All the machinery of that requires more activation, more excitation of the brain. We are programmed over development to have more excitation, more molecules that subserve excitation during childhood and teen years than an adult.
Teenagers are more prone to addiction. Why is that?
Well, addiction is actually a form of learning. And just like when I was talking about learning requires synaptic plasticity and enhancement of a synapse based on repeated exposure to facts in a memorization task, what happens in addiction is there's also repeated exposure, except it's to a substance. And it's not in the part of the brain we use for learning. It's in the reward-seeking area of your brain, the limbic system, someplace called the nucleus accumbens and the ventral tegmental area you read a lot about, and it's involving dopamine and other neurotransmitters. It's happening in the same way that learning stimulates and enhances a synapse. Substances do the same thing. They build a reward circuit around that substance to a much stronger, harder, longer, stronger addiction. Just like learning a fact is more efficient, sadly, addiction is more efficient in the adolescent brain. That is an important fact for an adolescent to know about themselves, that they can get addicted faster. It also explains why, and it also is a way to debunk a myth, by the way, that, oh, teens are resilient, they'll be fine, you know, he can just go off and drink or do this or that, they'll bounce back. Actually, it's quite the contrary. The effects of substances are more permanent on the teen brain. They have more deleterious effects and can be more toxic to the teen than in the adult.
Listen, there's an interesting paradox you point out when it comes to alcohol on the teenage brain. The teenage brain is more resilient when it comes to like the sedative effects of alcohol. Like, you know, they're not going to get tired as quickly. At the same time, that means they might drink more. So would you talk about that paradox?
Yeah. So the alcohol actually, because it's affecting critical machinery in the brain that is actually at higher levels in the teenager than in the adult, there's more of target material for alcohol in the developing brain than later in life. And hence, it can have a more toxic effect. There are studies that show that binge drinking, which is probably the worst scenario actually, binge drinking can actually kill brain cells in the adolescent brain where it does not to the same extent in the adult brain. So for the same amount of alcohol, you can actually have brain damage, permanent brain damage in an adolescent for the same blood alcohol level that may cause bad sedation in the adult, but not actual brain damage.
What about drinking's effect on memory? You know, teenagers are so good at learning and remembering. Does alcohol reverse that at all?
Yes.
Or impede it?
Yeah. So one of the things that we go through in the book is to talk about how do we learn? What is learning? And what are the targets for learning? And how do drugs lock onto those targets and impair them? Well, alcohol is one of those drugs, and it will actually counteract the effects of learning so that it will certainly impede learning. And there isn't as much of a bounce back from alcohol exposure in the adolescent brain when there's, in looking at experiments, looking at animal tissue, we see that there's a more permanent effect on learning in the adolescent compared to the adult.
So is alcohol likely to impair your ability to learn new things, or will it unravel the things you've already learned?
That's a very good question. Alcohol will impair you from even laying down a memory because it has a sedative effect, and it's actually causing more inhibition and blocking excitation. So we need excitation to learn, and it's actually diminishing that. So the process of learning doesn't even get started. And I think in the most extreme case, of course, you know, after a binge drinking, there's complete amnesia around the event, and even for the hours after having had a binging episode.
Well, let's look at marijuana. First of all, you point out that the marijuana of today is a lot more potent than the marijuana of the 60s or the 70s. So, like, things have really changed in terms of what teenagers are getting exposed to. But does marijuana have a particularly potent effect on the teenage brain?
Yeah, marijuana actually does have a different effect on the teenage brain than the adult. And this is one of those things that you want to let kids know about, that because they have more plasticity, more substrate, a lot of these drugs of abuse are going to lock on to more targets in their brains than in an adult, for instance. And it's interesting because we have natural cannabinoids, they're called, in the brain. We have kind of a natural substance that that actually locks onto receptors on brain cells. It has, for the most part, a more dampening sedative effect. So when you actually ingest or smoke or get cannabis into your bloodstream, it does get into the brain and it goes to these same targets. It turns out that these targets actually block the process of learning and memory so that you have an impairment of being able to lay down new memories. Now, what's interesting is not only does the teen brain have more places for the cannabis to actually land, if you will, it actually stays there longer. It locks on longer than in the adult brain. So there were studies done that showed that several days out, there's still impaired learning and memory, say, in experimental adolescent animals compared to adults where it's a more fleeting effect. So this is important for teenagers to know. For instance, if they were, you know, to get high over a weekend, the effects may be still there on Thursday and Friday later that week. An adult wouldn't have that same long-term effect.
You suggest that maybe teens and people in their 20s now, these being the first generation to actually grow up with devices, that they were exposed to electronic distractions from the start,
right,
that no one else in history has been exposed to. So their brains might be different in some fundamental way. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, it's all very speculative at this point in time because, of course, the experiment hasn't completed itself. This generation hasn't fully made it to, you know, full-fledged adulthood, which I would say would be sort of your mid-30s. So I think that if we look back and see how well the human brain has adapted to so many different things over the centuries. I mean, think about reading. Until about 3 or 4 centuries ago, it was very uncommon for humans to read. It was just the religious community and the academia that read, and most of the populations in even Western countries were not reading. So we've developed a reading brain over just those few centuries, and we've come to rely on it very, very heavily. So we hope that there are new skills being embedded in these brains as they learn how to deal with all this input. I guess my concern is that the teen period is rather vulnerable because the input's out there. We can't control it. We can't really control their access to it. But what is more concerning to me is that they are not mindful of how to manage this input.
So in talking about some of the things teenagers are prone to because their brain is still developing, one of the things is stress. So how does the development of the teenage brain figure into the possibility of being more stressed?
Right. So the teenage brain, like the childhood brain, is a very impressionable brain. The environment is molding it by the minute, right? So stress, just like substances, just like good experiences, are changing the wiring diagram of the brain and changing the chemistry of the brain and setting it up for future life. So stress, just like any other kind of stimulus, has been shown to have an effect on long-term brain health. Stressful situations in adolescence have been shown to increase the risk of depression, for instance, as adults. So we have to think about, you know, what is in our environment during the teen years.
So does the ability to learn more quickly figure into the stress too? Like, why are teenagers more prone to stress or to being moody?
Well, I think
– I don't know if those are the same thing.
Well, they're not, actually. Okay. So
let's stick with the stress then.
More prone to stress because they have more plasticity. They are – their synapses are being conditioned by whatever's in their environment. If stress is in their environment, they build synapses in a different way than they would without stress. And in the case of stress during the teen years, it can increase your risk of depression. So you are altering areas of your brain that would be – that are not functioning normally in depression.
So a stressed teenager is more likely to have depression as a teenager or into later life as well?
Later life as well. Now, interestingly, your mental state is very dependent upon how mature your brain is. Most mental illnesses, such as depression, bipolar, schizophrenia, tend to have their onset at the end of the teen years or early adult. This is not a coincidence. It is because to be able to actually manifest depression or schizophrenia, you need your prefrontal and frontal lobes. They're not connected yet until late teens. So it helps us understand why these diseases are actually quite silent earlier in life, and the person can appear completely normal and then have this onset in the early college years, usually it is, or, you know, late high school. We know there's an increased risk of suicide in this window of development, probably related to this. It's a time where you have enough of your systems working in order to actually manifest a depression, yet you don't have your frontal lobes for the impulse or risk-taking behavior. And suicide in part, for instance, is an impulsive act. So there isn't that gating. It's like, maybe I shouldn't do this, but it's done.
This has been fascinating. Thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been great having a chance to talk to you. Thank you.
Dr. Francis Jensen speaking with Terry Gross. Jensen is the chair of the Department of Neurology at the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine. Her new book is called The Teenage Brain. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Sherrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.